Welcome to the ITAM Review Podcast, news, reviews and resources for ITAM, SAM and software licensing professionals.
Hello, this is George from the ITAM Review.
And I'm Jennifer from the ITAM Forum.
And welcome to another of our joint podcasts with the ITAM Forum with the reigning winners of the ITAM Review Excellence Awards. So this is another collaboration. It's a mashup between these two organisations. So it's from my side, it's a fireside chat. On the ITAM Forum side, it's a Changemakers podcast. So we're bringing the two together for these conversations. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest for this podcast, which is Sarah Marriott, who's a director at Anglepoint. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks so much for inviting me.
No worries.
We're thrilled to have you. We're so excited to speak with the Excellence Awards winners.
And you were about your story. You were recently crowned Consultant of the Year 2023. So how did that feel, firstly?
Amazing. I was completely shocked. Someone wanted to record my reaction afterwards because I was so shocked. But, you know, it's so wonderful being recognised. And I was honestly thrilled to have even been nominated. That was the win for me, let alone being shortlisted and then winning. It was really wonderful to be recognised. You do all the hard work, but you don't expect the awards. But when it does happen, it was very meaningful.
They're a nice thing to do, aren't they? Because we get so stuck into the day-to-day and we very rarely get the chance to look back and that night was a good chance to do that. So congratulations. So obviously as this is a kind of a fireside chat, it's kind of about, I describe it as like the life and times of the people that we speak to. So, you know, behind the scenes of ITAM, because everyone's got a different story. It's always fascinating when you delve in a little bit. So do you want to just tell us a bit about yourself, really, where you live, work, kind of your background?
Sure. So I am Australian, if you can't already tell by the accent. So grew up in Sydney and then moved a little bit around the world. So I lived in Shanghai for a few years, then in Antwerp for a few years before going back home. And now I live in London with my husband. We love it here. It's home for us now. And so I've been at Anglepoint for the last 4.5 years or so. Worked in a couple of different roles, but really loving life in London now.
What was it that brought you to London? Oh, sorry. Sorry, Jen.
Oh, no. I was interested to know, about your travels and how you got to the UK and what you were doing before you started in the crazy world of ITAM.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a bit different for kids when they grow up overseas. You kind of see world a little bit differently. And I always knew that I wanted to live overseas as an adult. And I've been so fortunate to travel to lots of different countries. And when I met my husband on our first date, actually, he said that's something that he really wanted to do and really wanted to try and experience for himself. So we came to London on a holiday, a European holiday, and kind of decided on the tube one night that this is where we wanted to live. And so we packed up, had no job, no lease or anything, stayed with some friends of ours, and here we are now.
Right. Wow, that's fantastic. So when was it that you ended up in London?
Oh, September 2019. And so, of course, you move with all the hopes and dreams of quick European holidays and enjoying all of that. And we managed a couple. And then, of course, COVID hit. Mm-hmm. And then we
all went out the window.
All went out the window. We were stuck inside. But actually, we really loved living in London during lockdown because everyone had left. So you could just walk around in the parks and kind of enjoy the day-to-day rather than all the hustle and bustle of everything else that you get when the city's full.
So So had you done ITAM before you came to London, or is this?
I hadn't. This
yeah.
was
interesting.
This yeah. was my first time, so relatively new. But before coming to Angle Point, I've had a very varied career. I've done lots of different things. So I've bought and sold software. I've looked after technology procurement and contract processes. And I even wrote code when I was working for a ticketing company in Australia and helped migrate their platforms over into the cloud, creating a brand new mobile application. So it was kind of the perfect intersection when I came to ITAM, and it's been really helpful to see it from all different sides, both the contract side of things and the technology side of things, which has proven to be very helpful.
I would think that, yes, coming, especially with that procurement and contract negotiation hat and experience, that also would add credibility when, you know, when you're speaking to clients and helping them in those specific areas, because you've been on the other side, you know.
Absolutely. And empathy is super important in any job. You know, being a program manager and leading a lot of change management initiatives, and also kind of working with lots of different people from different parts of organizations, it kind of all came together. And I often think back to earlier in my career at different points, and you know, it might have been some very small specific thing, but it's become relevant to what I do today.
That's great.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's like you were training for ITAM, you just didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know it. That's exactly right.
I'm sure there are films with montages like that.
Yeah.
Not about ITAM, but you know.
Absolutely. And like many people who come to ITAM didn't even realize this was an industry before I had joined, you know, working for very large technology services firms, IBM, DXC. I think everyone needs to kind of spend their time, pay their dues at those organizations. It's very helpful. And then I've discovered this completely different world of ITAM, and Angle Point's been such a fantastic place to work, to understand, to learn, and to really listen and work, have the pleasure of working with so many different clients to kind of bring everything all together.
Do you think ITAMers, let's call them ITAM professionals, do you think they have a good connection with procurement teams at the moment or not? Or how would you suggest the coming together of those two teams, you know, so that they can work closer together?
It's so hard, and we find it really depends on the organization and how it's structured. I've worked with one client, for example, where the ITAM team was actually part of the procurement team. And so you would expect they were very closely aligned, but still kind of their primary focus was procurement and the ITAM part was relatively new. So it was a different kind of skill set. But more broadly, it's a tough relationship. In ITAM, working with any other team within an organization, we're often the ones finding the skeletons in the closet, right? We're finding the dirty laundry, and it's our job and responsibility to find it and to work with our clients and the stakeholders to try to do something about it, right? We find what we find based on the analysis and the data that we have, but then we need to put in place a remediation plan. And what I like about how we operate at Angle Point is it's very much, we're going to help you do it. We're not like, oh, hey, here's a recommendation, good luck. It's okay, this is what we've found, let's roll up our sleeves and let's help you to actually do something about it. And with procurement, it happens all the time. We have to work so closely with them because they can negotiate a contract. Many people in procurement don't have an ITAM background, don't fully understand the nuances, especially the technical side, and the impact that one tiny line of a contract or term and condition, what impact that can have on ITAM, what impact that can have on the end users who are using those licenses. And so, you know, sometimes it's us making recommendations, how can they optimize their contract, negotiate the price down, but then that might also come with other risks if there are different trade-offs. So I think part of it is having that trust and respect, and also guiding them that we can to try to help some of the risks and optimizations, because we can't do it without them and they can't do it without us. But how that's structured, I think, plays a big factor, I suppose. I've seen on both mm-hmm. sides where it works really well and where it's not worked so well.
Right.
But I hope that we can keep working closely together.
How do you find, obviously at Anchor Point, you're an external partner that's been brought in to help these people. And obviously you're trying to introduce some governance that might not have been there previously. And, you know, finding those skeletons in the cupboard and sorting out what's there. Is that, do you think that's easier or harder as someone who's external? Or does that depend on the partners that brought you in, for the, you know, the stakeholders on their side? Like, how have you found that?
It's tough. Again, I've seen it all sorts of different ways. I've seen it work best when we have that partner mindset. And that's something that we always talk about at Angle Point, is we're not an extension of the organization's ITAM team. We are an embedded part of the team. So, you know, for some of our clients, we have coffee catch-ups and just lunches where we're not allowed to talk about work, but we just have those, you know, genuine relationships, because we work with them all day, every day. And that's important, because unless you have that trust and respect, you can't get stuff done. And that's ultimately yeah. what we're always here to try to get, to drive to those outcomes. So if what that means is we have to understand how that organization works, that can take a really, really long time, because we are external. We're not necessarily going to have visibility into everything that's going on, but the more visibility and more access that we get, and the more relationships we have with people from across the organization, the easier it's going to be for us to have those conversations, especially when they're not so nice conversations, or we're sharing some bad news. But then, you know, with our clients, they know that even if we're going to do that, we're going to help them. It's not just a kind of shifting across the line or whatever the case might be. And sometimes we also find that our clients will say, hey, Sarah, do you mind, could you present this to the CIO or to whoever it might be, because the impact might be stronger coming from an external person.
Yeah.
You know, we're brought in not only as an extra pair of hands to pick up some of the work that a lot of our clients don't have the headcount to be able to do themselves, but we're also brought in as that specialist. We have the benefit of working with lots of organizations across the world and seeing what's happening and what works, what doesn't work. We've been so fortunate to be recognized by Gartner and the MQ as mm-hmm. A leader for the fourth year running since it's been existed, and, you know, highest and furthest to the right. We are that trusted partner. And so it does work well, but we need to have that visibility, be that embedded part of the team, and then we're able to do so much. It's really exciting.
Fantastic. Yeah,
I agree. I agree with that. I do a completely different job to you, but I have worked sort of on the consulting side, actually. So is George. And I completely agree. If you're not embedded, if you are treated like an external person, there is only so much you can do. It's really when you're treated just the same as them, so to speak, you are really embedded team member, that you can make the biggest contribution, which is really what they're paying you to do anyway. So
exactly.
should we delve a little bit into your role a bit more? I think Jen, do you want to
I'm really interested to know what and obviously, you know, you've talked about your background, which is, like, as George said, you were training for ITAM before you even knew that ITAM existed. But what do you like the most about being a consultant?
I love that we have that variety. You know, it's never boring. There's always so much to do with any one organization. We're looking ahead, not just at what is happening today, but looking across the industry. What are the trends? What should we be anticipating for the future? And really having those relationships with lots of different clients. Certainly there are benefits of working internally within an organization in that ITAM role. And there are pros and cons to both, but I love consulting. I love the, you know, adrenaline when you're presenting a high stakes presentation and, you know, obsessed with trying to make it as good as you can, because you're there as that trusted advisor, as that specialist. So that's what keeps it really exciting for me.
Now, I'm very conscious of how silly this question is going to sound when considering you're a consultant, but is there a typical day, you know, when you've got multiple clients and stuff, and you know, I'm actually being pulled left, right and center, like, is that the typical day, I suppose?
Yes. I always start my day with a double espresso and, you know, my very classical Vegemite on toast type of Australian girl. But, you know, for me, clear out the inbox, figure out what's happened. We are a global organization with clients everywhere, so especially with the US or APAC, you want to check your emails and get up to speed. I have a lot of meetings, as you can probably imagine, so I spend a lot of my time talking with clients, helping them with their outcomes, achieve their outcomes, figuring out what's gone wrong. Something's always gone wrong, if it's internal or external, and so you're trying to be in that problem solving mode to put out any fires, reassure clients, make sure everything's okay and you've got a plan in place. So that tends to be what a typical but never typical day looks like for me.
Do you have anything kind of big on your plate at the moment? Any big challenges that you're working through?
I think the common challenge that I'm seeing across the board, and it's always a constant push and pull, is that we have clients across the maturity spectrum, right? And there's a lot of focus at the moment on what I call the shiny toys or mm-hmm. trying to catch butterflies. And that's with FinOps and Green IT. And it's so important that ITAM are part of those conversations, because we can bring so much to them. We have an important role, that's not disputed, but then actually getting there and being part of these conversations is a different story. I think a challenge that I'm noticing is sometimes clients want to go for the shiny toys and they forget about the basics. And it's really important, or we keep reminding our clients that we have to focus on the basics. We need to get the foundation of the program in place. We have to have that good governance, because if you skip and then you just focus on FinOps, or you migrate to a new SAM tool or whatever the case might be, if you don't have those foundations in place, it will all topple over eventually. We're seeing that clients more and more are migrating, say, for example, to FlexAero 1. But if you don't have good data integrity and you don't have trustworthy data and CMDB information that's coming through, you're not going to get the most benefit out of the power of a tool such as F1. And so the challenge that I see is that constant push and pull. We want to be ahead of the market. We're working closely with our clients who are ready for that. But we also have to remind our clients that perhaps aren't quite as mature. We need to focus on those foundations, because if you lose sight of that, then you don't know what's going to happen.
I was thinking about maturity levels as you were talking, and then you said it, and I thought, oh, okay, I'm thinking the right thing. And going after those sort of, you know, shiny new toys or those unicorns, so to speak, butterflies, as I think you said, that really, I would imagine, it is really about maturity. Maybe the more mature organizations are in a better position to actually go after those because they have all that foundation in place and they've been doing it for a while. So it's becoming sort of maybe not second nature, but they're more used to it so that they can then go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You said that sometimes it's the client that might be driving that shiny penny thing, because we did an article on this off the back of a question that someone raised at the last Wisdom conference, you know, asking whether the tools vendors were focusing too much on the next shiny thing, because obviously we're at a conference, everyone's talking about the next shiny thing because it's topical, people want to learn about it. So are they doing that at the expense of the core stuff? But you know, you raise a good point that it equally could be, you know, on the customer side, you know, that's, you know, we all get distracted by shiny things, I think is the moral of that story. And sometimes we just got to get the basics right before we got to what
you have to walk before you can run. Yeah.
That's it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Should we talk a little bit about the award itself? When the awards come through, they're nominated. Someone puts a nomination through, and they have to they put a name forward, and then they have to kind of explain why they think this person should get the award. And in your nomination, someone described, this is where I have to embarrass you a bit, you see, they described you as a highly skilled and appreciated partner to them. And there was one thing that caught my attention was that you successfully disproven several audit allegations and negotiated collaborative approaches with multiple vendors to improve transparency and minimise risk. I thought that was quite a thing, that the multiple allegations and negotiating a collaborative approach to resolve those. Are you able to expand a little bit on what happened there?
Sounds like a solicitor or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about a legal career.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's quite a tale, if you will, and this is built up over many years. I was working with a client who had paid every year on average for 4 years to one vendor on cases of alleged pirated software. So when you talk about pirated software, think cracked keys, anything that's not been purchased from a genuine source. And of course, this is a very serious issue, not obviously from the financial standpoint of what the organization paid, but also security risks, risk of malware infections, for example. It's a legal risk in some jurisdictions. And actually, the vendor said, enough is enough. Let's bring in an external third party to help get this under control. And so they gave us a call, we came in, and, you know, one of the main rules of general audits is don't pay anything until you can verify what they're alleging, because you don't know if it's true or not. But when it comes to pirated software, I think it's a little bit different. Panic sets in because it is so serious. As that fresh pair of eyes, we came in and looked at it and said, okay, well, you've detected these traces through phone home technology. It's an engineering application. So you've used phone home technology. No technology is 100% perfect. And so then we start drilling down into these spreadsheets of 50, 100 lines worth of allegations, and we say, hang on a second, we don't even have enough information in here to determine whether it belongs to this client's estate. You're just giving us information that's not particularly helpful for us to be able to verify. So we're negotiating with the vendor. There are some limitations of what they could provide. They were able to give us a bit more information. And we set up this process collaboratively with the vendor. So they send over a quarterly list of allegations. We then have now reactive processes in place. That spreadsheet goes through InfoSec and other teams to identify, can you find it in the environment? 9 times out of 10, the answer is no. And the vendor accepts that if they can't provide us with enough information and we have tried to locate that device matching that profile and we can't, then no more. The claim stops there. And then if we are able to identify any of those devices, that then gets handed to our specialists in our team. They provide, or they undertake this forensic analysis of the device to look at everything that's installed on there. And so then they can check, is that device clean, or perhaps are there instances of cracked keys on the device? And so we've got this process now that kind of has flown through of, you know, what happens if scenario A, we do find it, well, then there is a payment that's made. If we find the device, but we verify that it's clean, then no payment is made, a stat deck is signed, and then we move on until the following quarter. And as we've implemented this new process, we've only been able to identify a handful, certainly less than 10 devices in the years since implementing this. And we've, as belonging to that client's estate, and we've only verified one allegation. Mm. The rest we've disproven because we couldn't find it. And so when you think about prior to our involvement, having $2.5 million on average per year, to now a very small amount for a needed license that they've now paid for, it's game changing, and it just for me has the importance of talking to our software publishers and making sure that we do have that collaborative approach, which having that dialogue, because that dialogue is really important. We don't want pirated software in our estate as much as they don't want pirated software in our estate, because it's bad for them, it's bad for us. We don't want it. Okay, we have that commitment. Let's set up this process and have very firmly the rule that we won't pay for anything unless it's verified. So that's one example. We've had others as well, and it's... It's a strong testament to the power of the process. I know some people think that ITAM can get tied up in knots of documenting, and you know, we want to make sure that that's as close to reality as possible. So that's part of the reactive process if there's allegations that come from any vendor relating to pirated software. And then of course it's the proactive part. And what we discovered is there was no actual policy saying pirated software was bad. And so from a corrective standpoint of having a conversation with an employee where there had been something verified, they couldn't do much about it. So we had to start from scratch, have a SAM policy. Okay, this is outlining exactly what pirated software is, why it is bad. We had training programs. And so then we're protecting ourselves from that governance standpoint, from an employee contract perspective, with, you know, clear outline of what would happen next. And that's how it all needs to come together to address the root cause of the issue.
Makes me wonder where the these allegations are coming from, like the data that they're pulling. Mm-hmm. If it's that inaccurate, but wow, and of that $2.5 million per year, was that all down to allegations, or was that their overall spend with that vendor, and then a proportion of that was based on the allegations?
Good question. Part of it was penalties. Part of it was being forced into unfavorable contracts and forced to pay for lots of licenses they didn't want or need. And they told the publisher, I'm never going to use these. And they said, I don't care. Sign away.
Wow.
So it's a combination, but regardless, lots of money wasted that could have been spent on other things. But sometimes it's the hard lessons you need to go through that pain to be able to have that trigger point of then doing something serious about it.
I suppose if you're on the receiving end of those allegations, I guess the initial thing is you feel your hands are tied.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a problem to fix here, and how do we fix it? But that's why they need a consultant like you to come in and defend them. So that's interesting. I mean, it leads us onto kind of the perception of ITAM is always one we like to delve into. And obviously, you work with a number of companies, and we've talked about different levels of maturity within those companies. Is ITAM perceived differently in those? And are there some of those phone calls of like ITAM who? What are you? You know, and others are like, yes, come on in. We work together. You know, how is it generally seen?
Absolutely. I got an email last week from a stakeholder, and you know, data collection's always fun. Especially when you're working with decentralized organizations and you're asking people to give you data, and you have to kind of explain why. What is the ITAM program? What are we here to do? This is what we're going to use your data that we're requesting for, right? To identify, determine compliance, mitigate risk, get cost savings. And someone literally just replied and said, I have no idea what program you're talking about. Please explain.
Wow.
To be fair, I haven't gotten an email like that in a long time, but it did make me chuckle. It does depend on the organization. You know, for those that are large, we're embedded. You know, we're messaging each other on WhatsApp if we need to, right? There's no problems there. And part of it is almost over-communicating. So you have that reputation and people need to, they need to understand. But it's, you know, if people don't know what you're talking about or what an ITAM program is, they're certainly not going to help you with whatever it is that you're asking for. So I think that comms plan people often forget about say this is what we're here to achieve. We have an ITAM program charter statement. That's the first thing that we do when we engage with a new organization. We have a workshop and we say, okay, what are we here to do? What's our goal and how are we going to achieve it? And so making sure that that's known is helpful, but thankfully it's not too bad. People know who you are and you get into that rhythm of providing the data every 6 months, quarterly, whatever the cadence happens to be.
Interesting. And then changing gears slightly, when someone asks you what ITAM is, like not talking about with clients but with anyone outside of work, how do you explain this peculiar little niche of IT to them?
It's always fun, isn't it, trying to explain it. Sometimes I try, sometimes I just don't bother. The way I try to explain it to people is every organization buys software, but they often don't manage it in the way that you would typically a physical asset like a building or a lease. And yet companies spend far more money on software than they do on buildings, physical assets. So ITAM ensures that people have access to the software licenses they need when they need it, on the device they need it on. So we help them get their job done, because if they don't have access to any of those things, they can't work. And that can cost organizations a huge amount of money. And ITAM also ultimately is trying to help companies save money and to manage risk. So we compare what they've bought to what they're using. And if they're using less than what they've bought, then there's some cost savings potentially there and optimizations. Or if they're using more than what they've bought, or they're not using it in quite the right way per the terms and conditions, then that's a potential risk in an audit. And software publishers more and more are auditing as a form of a revenue stream. So we're trying to get ahead of that curve and help clients proactively before it becomes a problem.
I think that's a good description. That's better one of the better ones I've heard. Yes.
It's good because you can go too abstract with that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, what? Yeah. Depends who you're speaking to, I suppose.
Also very true. Yeah.
It's good. Shall we just briefly go up to kind of talk about your career really kind of today and kind of mentors and how you've kind of got to where you are? So have you had any mentors along the way? You obviously, they don't specifically need to be ITAM, but just, you know, anything really.
Yeah, I've been really lucky to have some fantastic mentors in my career, and I keep in touch with many of them even from, you know, 15, 20 years ago, which is really lovely. And I think the power or the influence that a mentor can have is can be so impactful, because they say things that you often just would never expect or anticipate. One of them said to me, just say yes. Even if you don't feel like you're ready, or you have the experience, or if you can do it, just say yes. It's really simple, basic advice, but I don't know if I would have gotten into ITAM if I hadn't followed that advice. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this crazy industry I've never heard of before? But I thought, why not? Let's give this a go and look where we are. Look where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Consultant of the year. There you go. If you hadn't have said yes, that award would not be yours this year.
That's mine.
You can thank that mentor. I hope you contacted the person and told them.
I did. Oh, goodness, I'm blushing.
They didn't ask you to sort of cut the award in half or anything and said, I want half of it, you know, send it to me.
No, my client did. Though, so I said, well, it's really your fault because you nominated me, so he knows what's coming next year, or this year, I should say.
Excellent. Jen, did you want to go through any of
questions? Just would why do you think ITAM is a great career option or choice?
Even if you've never heard of it before, I definitely do agree that ITAM is a great career choice because it's so uniquely positioned. Mm-hmm. We really are at the intersection of everything of what organizations do and how they operate. And the best part about ITAM is if you don't lose sight of, at the end of the day, you're helping people do their job. That's what we're trying. We want to make sure they have those licenses so they can get their job done. They have the hardware that they need so they can get their job done. And so, you know, it's so varied in your role, because sometimes you're having presentations to executives, and increasingly this is a very important topic for executives, as we think about cost savings, also risk reduction. When we get some very nasty audits, that is going to the C-level, and they want to understand why, and why it was not budgeted, and why it has happened because of a lack of process or whatever the case might be. So one day you're talking to the CIO or the CEO, as the case might be, and then the next you're talking to you know, an engineer or someone, a database admin, and you're saying, hey, do you mind? Can you please change your habits? Because actually, you're not allowed to be using those licenses in that way. Or, you know, can we switch over? By the way, did you know that this is actually not allowed? So, it's varied because you have that exposure and get to interact with so many different people. But also, you need to have that combination of the soft skills to influence change and convince people, explain what is ITAM, but then also be able to read contracts and to have a technical understanding. And that's actually quite difficult to find people that have that combination of skills. But if you can get there, if you can learn them, then certainly it's you're well positioned for any future role in a different type of position, right, should you so choose.
Right. And we hear that quite often about this more the soft skills, sort of those communication, influencing type skills, you know, talking to different people at different levels within the organization or different, you know, departments, different roles, and bringing it back to them, you know, how you're showing value to them, how you're going to help them.
Absolutely. And it's so hard. And especially as, you know, as executives, they're going to be distracted and most concerned about that big risk number. You know, wow, you've got $100 million worth of risk, that this is a serious problem. And then you're trying to convince them, well, actually, yes, that's a serious problem, but that's just a symptom of the root cause of that problem. Sorry to distract you, but now we need to start looking at that governance and laying the foundations of a proper ITAM program. And can you please help us with budget, which is so hard to get these days in any organization? Mm-hmm. Budget for the ITAM program, having the top-down buy-in to say you must have agents installed on every device, and these really basic things, but it's certainly never boring.
That's good.
Okay. It is. It's fun.
Well, I think that's everything for me that I wanted to know. That I can't think of anything else we haven't covered.
No, we've gone through. I think we've gone through everything. We've gone very deep with this one. Is there anything else you wanted to say, Sarah? Other than thanks for the award. It's great.
Well, yes, that is what I was going to say, George. It's very much appreciated, and it is such an honour. You know, it's so lovely to be recognised when often ITAM is not perhaps the most glamorous of industries. It's often underappreciated within organisations, even though the impact, the real impact of what we're having is so large, both from a financial standpoint and those softer impacts of building trust and respect. So it's very much appreciated, unexpected and lovely, and it means a lot. So thank you very much.
Well, congratulations again.
Well, pass those. I mean, those thanks really, not for us, are they? They're for the panel, really, aren't they, Jen, that actually reviewed them? Because it's, you know, it's quite a large panel that reviews these. And obviously, there's quite a few nominations that come in, and then they look through them all. So, it's, you know, it's been through quite a process for you to come out on top. So, congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me today. This was a fun chat. Thanks.
No worries. Well, I think we'll leave it here. All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, everyone.